Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Howard Phillips Smith, whose new book is A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. Smith is also the author of Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans, and the co-author of Southern Decadence in New Orleans. We'll also hear from Claudia Gray, author of House of L, Book 1, The Shadow Threat, the story of the origin of Superman. Howard Phillips Smith is the author of the gorgeous book Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans, and the co-author of Southern Decadence in New Orleans. He's speaking to us today about his fascinating new book, A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. We're speaking to him today from his home in Los Angeles. Howard, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hi there, Susan. Good to be back.
Now, Jack Robinson was one of the most intriguing figures in your book, Unveiling the Muse, so I was delighted to learn more about him. And you call him a solitary sphinx. You have to feel very strongly about a person to undertake a book like this. So what was your connection? What drew you to his life story?
Just his life in New Orleans. He grew up in Mississippi and moved to New Orleans in the mid-40s to go to Tulane. And just his life in New Orleans was fascinating enough, but he lived in New York and then he became a famous fashion photographer there and gave it all up and moved to Memphis where his family had settled to take care of his mom. We could know nothing about him if he hadn't saved all of his negatives, his photographs and negatives. So it's three fascinating chapters in his life, but this book focuses on New Orleans when he was young and carefree, and it is just an incredible story.
So many people have told me over the course of years, you know, they say, and then I got to New Orleans and I got to be myself. And it sounds like that's what happened to Jack. He came here to be a student and he found his calling while he was here.
He did. I think that happened to me too, if I can be honest.
You're from Mississippi too.
I'm from Mississippi, but I was always going to New Orleans. I still am. It's just, it's the most incredible place in the world, I feel. But you can almost, just writing the book, you can almost feel him gaining confidence and making connections with people and people with like-minded people, straight and gay in the French Quarter. It was just an incredible time. And, you know, he was in the right place at the right time. He documented so many things in their genesis, you know, when they were just forming. And we talk about Preservation Hall. We talk about the gay carnival cruise. He was there before all that happened.
So talk a little bit about Jack's involvement with the New Orleans art scene here in the 50s, his friendship with Dusty Bonger, Gene Seidenberg, Betty Parsons, the New York dealer who was here visiting all the time. So he was part of a really influential crowd of artists.
He was. This is just such an incredible story, and it was just so exciting to uncover all these different layers and what they meant to the art scene in New Orleans. I'm going to circle back in a minute, but I just have to say that my conclusion after studying all of this, studying his documentation, is that New Orleans can hold its head up very high during the 50s as a center of contemporary art. These artists and their influence, I think, is really strong. I think it needs to be acknowledged more, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, especially with the Orleans Gallery, which formed in 56. Jack was there to document, participate in this amazing art scene in the early 50s. Dusty Bonger, there's an incredible new book about her. I mean, she is just a fascinating character in this story. And she was close friends with Jack Robinson and his partner, Gabriel.
And we're only really beginning to appreciate her work, I think.
Absolutely. She's been left out of the discourse, which infuriates me. Several years ago, there was, and deservedly so, an exhibition focusing on the women in the abstract expressionism movement. Mm-hmm. And this started out in Denver, and it traveled around. Everyone was in it except Dusty Bonger, glaringly left out of this really important exhibit. So I think with the exhibit that happened at the Ogden and with this new book by Richard Gruber, and hopefully some of the things that I put forward in the book, you can see that she was a talent. She was just an exceptional artist.
And so generous to her friends.
Yes.
And there were some other people around this circle who were so interesting as well. I mean, there are some great photographs of Ella Brennan in this book.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God is right.
When I selected all of the images for the book, there was no booklet that came with the photographs and who these people were and how important they were. This is all historical research. But, you know, of course, everyone knew Ella Brennan. But this is Ella when she first started out, when Brennan's restaurant was on Bourbon Street. And just her presence and her incredible gift for food and restaurant, crafting her restaurant. But make no mistake, she was part of the scene. She ran around with everyone. She knew Jack. Friends would come to the restaurant. She would go to Miss Dixie's bar with people and Cafe Lafitte when he was in the blacksmith shop. She actually said in an interview, a lot of girls go to finishing school. I got my education from Cafe Lafitte.
Right. And there's this wonderful picture of her standing in the doorway of Brennan's, shaking hands with some arrivals, just ramrod straight, but looking so welcoming in that way she has.
That's smart.
That's a wonderful photo.
Businesswoman. Yes, and then there's Peggy Lee. You know, so many stars came there. And there's an accounting of their really cheap martini lunches, and it was jam-packed. The restaurant was packed. So I just wish I could have gone.
I know. That's the other thing. You do wish you could be there. And, of course, Lee Bailey. Talk about his role in all this.
Lee Bailey is another beloved New Orleans character. He was from a small town in Louisiana, Bunkie, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But he came to New Orleans and just thrived. He was part of the scene. He was good friends with Jack Robinson. He encouraged Jack Robinson. He eventually moved to New York and wrote cookbooks and became very successful with like a houseware store. And he opened a couple of restaurants with Lee Klein, who was the partner of Leonard Parrish. These are people who when they came back to New Orleans, they were feted. They were acknowledged in the newspapers. Oh, Lee Bailey is in town. We're going to interview him with Ella Brennan, who wrote a cookbook with him. He was just a native son and just so beloved and very successful.
I have all his cookbooks, you know.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I do. And he had a cooking school here, too.
Well, he encouraged Jack Robinson, and rightly so. They worked together, actually.
And, of course, let's talk a little bit about these photographs. They are so beautiful. I especially love the Mardi Gras photos from 1954. And they're centered on the scene at Dixie's Bar of Music. And there's one of Clay Shaw that is just a knockout.
Let me just start out with answering that question by saying Jack Robinson was on the street during that Fat Tuesday. He was taking photographs. But let's make no mistake, he did not take snapshots. These photographs, in my mind, are fully realized compositions.
Right.
And he had a camera with him all the time. He knew how to create a photograph, a mood. This one's Clay Shaw. It shows his intelligence. He just sparkles in this photo. He's dressed up as Socrates. on Fat Tuesday, and he's just having fun. He's there, relaxed with his friends. You just have to kind of rein yourself in from thinking, look what you've got ahead of you.
Oh, yeah.
So, but here he is. He's at Dixie's Bar. He's having fun. And I couldn't include all of the series of photographs with Clay Shaw, but Jack Robinson followed him into the French Quarter during the day, and there are a lot of photographs of him.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Howard Philip Smith, whose new book is A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. One of the things about this book is that it's so rich. It cuts across so many fields, and it reveals layers of meaning in each one of them. As we've been talking, it fills in gaps in the history of the art scene in New Orleans, in gay history here as well, because these were important figures in gay life in New Orleans, as well as the history of the world of fashion. After Robinson moved to New York, he began to work with some legendary editors like Carrie Donovan and Diana Vreeland at Vogue, who said, of course, pink is the navy blue of India, one of my favorite things. And Jack was part of all that.
Not to mention, he was part of Andy Warhol's entourage.
That too, yes.
I think it speaks to his talent. I think it speaks to being at the right place at the right time. He made connections with Betty Parsons when he and Gabriel and Dusty Bonger and Betty Parsons went to Mexico in the summer of 54. When he moved to New York, he had his skill set ready to go, and he ran with it. Unfortunately, I think he burned out pretty quickly when he was in New York. And I also think that when Gabriel died, his partner, in the late 60s, that had a profound impact on him, and he gave it all up. He was at the top of the heap, but he gave it all up and moved to Memphis, and he never photographed again.
But he did other artistic things.
Oh, yes. He was resurrected as a stained glass designer. So, and he was quite good at that. He was, he had worked as a graphic designer in New Orleans. And he designed the fantastic stained glass windows for the St. Jude Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. He did prosper in Memphis. He was very solitary. No one really knew him well. In fact, when he passed away, his employer, Dan Oppenheimer, who opened up the archive of his work, didn't even know he was a fashion photographer. Very surprised to find, 100,000 negatives secreted away in the basement of his building in downtown Memphis.
I know, that's an amazing moment in the interview with
incredible.
Dan. It's just,
yeah.
Wow. So is he still a mystery to you, or do you feel like you know him now? I noticed there aren't many images of him.
No, there's not.
There's one really adorable one, but I mean.
Yeah, it's cute. It was very
yeah.
cute. I think I know him as much as I can know him. I feel I've lived with him for the past, 4 or 5 years. There's just so many factors in his life that I think we can't know, really. I think Dan Oppenheimer's daughter, Emily, who wrote the foreword to the book, I think she expressed it best. The years he lived in New Orleans, I think that's the Jack that we know most about, and that's the one we want to get to know, the one who was just so carefree and so creative. And that's what I focus on, really. As a footnote, you mentioned all the fashion photography in New York. Very little of his fashion photography, other than, which was actually published in Vogue and all of that, that has not been published. So there's another archive ready for the picking.
Well, his editorial work was so amazing, too. Near the beginning of the book, there are these fantastic portraits of Jack Nicholson and Joni Mitchell, so many celebrities. You invite us to imagine what he's saying to them to get them to trust him so completely.
those incredible photographs. He definitely had the knack to capture these celebrities and make them more, I don't know, open a window into who they might be. I did choose photographs that had never been published before, and there's just some, again, really interesting ones of actresses and celebrities at the beginning of their careers, like Marissa Berenson, Liza Minnelli, Tina Turner. I mean,
oh, the Tina Turner photograph is stunning.
It's just incredible.
So what's your favorite? Can you pick one?
Favorite photograph?
Yeah.
From the book?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good one. You know, I think it has to be that Picasso costume out in front of Miss Dixie.
That was an all-time high in Mardi Gras costuming, I have to say.
Well, let me tell you, for months and months and months, I kept looking at that photograph, and my husband, who works with art history and art historical images, I said, what is this reference? And he said, oh, it's just probably nothing. But it references a real painting by Picasso. And this painting is so interesting. It's one of his mistresses, and she's looking in the mirror, but the mirror reveals her kind of darker side, her sinister side. And this is all very cubist rendering of this woman. And the costume that was created is split into two people, the girl in front of the mirror and the sinister girl inside the mirror. So a spectacular costume, but just a really great photograph, too.
And such layers of richness that he would be attuned to. One of the other things he did while he was in New Orleans was strike up a friendship with the influential Williams family.
Yes, Jack Robinson knew Margaret Williams from the very influential Williams family, who founded the Historic New Orleans Collection. Margaret Williams was the wife of Lawrence Williams, who was the son of Kemper Williams of the Historic New Orleans Collection. And, of course, Kemper Williams leased the space to the artist who created the Orleans Gallery. And, you know, Jack Robinson was right there with them. Margaret Williams, she was an interesting character, too, I think. She opened a modern store on St. Charles Avenue. She sold, you know, housewares there. And Jack Robinson would photograph her and, well, even her daughters, her beautiful daughters, he photographed them for their debutante parties. And she worked with Jean Seidenberg and Lee Bailey in their small business, throwing debutante parties, things like that.
And to think of debutante parties as an artistic endeavor, that it gave work to artists to design them.
And they were very serious about it.
Absolutely.
When I interviewed Gene Seidenberg, he said it was just incredible. Lee Bailey would construct things, centerpieces for the tables at the parties, and it was a successful business. And from time to time, Jack Robinson would photograph for them, do portraits of uptown debutantes and matrons, that type of thing.
One of those amazing things you find in New Orleans. We've been talking with Howard Philip Smith, whose new book is A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. Howard, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Show me if you like it. Lend me your ears and read me like a book. This conversation, it strikes me.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Claudia Gray back to The Reading Life. That's actually the pseudonym for New Orleans writer Amy Vincent. Claudia is the writer of multiple young adult novels, including the Evernight series, the Firebird trilogy, and the Constellation trilogy. In addition, she's written several Star Wars books, such as Lost Stars and Bloodline. In her new book, she's taking on one of the oldest and most beloved stories in the comics universe, The Legend of Superman. The first book in her new graphic novel series is House of L, The Shadow Threat, created with artist Eric Sawatsky. Claudia Gray, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan.
This graphic novel is so much fun, but tell us a little bit about how hard it must have been to take on the Superman origin story.
Yeah, it's a little intimidating. So, okay, here's your first time ever writing comics. Here's Superman. It's not where you expect to start. But on the other hand, I'm going to date myself here. I was 8 when Superman the movie came out, which really sort of marked the beginning of the current sort of superhero culture, I think.
Yeah.
And seeing that movie and seeing Superman's backstory, that was hugely formative for me in terms of waking up my imagination. I remember making up stories about Krypton when I was a very little kid. So finally, I get to put that to good use.
So how did your partnership with Eric come about? You must have had to agree on some basic ideas before you started. Talk about that whole process of doing a graphic novel. It fascinates me.
That is normally how it would work, but poor Eric kind of had to hit the ground running. We originally were going to work with one artist, and they had a serious illness come up, and then we're going to work with another artist, and they had a serious illness come up. And when Eric took the job, at first it was like, you know, do I need to warn this man? You know, I kind of feel like Spinal Tap with the drummers.
Yeah.
So he had to come in really late, and normally we would have collaborated much more, but thank goodness, so talented and so imaginative. He really took a few sticks of visual information that I had put there and built with them to make something amazing. The only real suggestions I'd given, I was like, okay, the one thing we know absolutely is Kryptonian always is that S symbol.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, so it's very angular. Everything's all these angles and different sort of polyhedrons and this sort of thing. And an emphasis on color. And he took that and ran with it. And I think the results are pretty spectacular.
Now, this must pose some particular writing challenges for you, say more emphasis on dialogue and storyboarding ahead of time and stuff like that. How did you find that?
It was a big challenge. I had read books and, you know, things online about writing comics, and I took an online course, and I knew, therefore, you know, in my mind, okay, you have to trust the pictures to tell part of the story. But it's one thing to know that, and it's another thing to have your creative imagination actually accept that and start to work with it. And it took several pages before I was able to go, oh, you know, they don't have to say that. They don't have to point that out. Hey, wouldn't the image actually tell this better than the word? You know, in some ways, it's kind of like doing a trust fall.
Right.
And just believe, like, yes, the artist has her back, and Eric had mine, which is great. But, yeah, and I learned a lot. I really feel like this has been an incredible learning experience, and not just in how to write graphic novels, but in terms of, you know, I realized, well, I write a lot of dialogue, and sometimes it's good to maybe have people get to the chase, you know, or there are a lot more visual ways to communicate information than maybe I'm using all the time. So I think it was a really valuable exercise. Maybe everybody should try writing a graphic novel.
Now, this is the first in a planned trilogy, and that's a form I think you like because you've done it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
So when you work this way, have you planned it all the way through to the end? And how long is the wait for the next one?
Roughly, I had it planned all the way through to the end. I knew where it would end. I knew what the major beat for Sarah and Zahn would be. As we were writing, some of the subplots ended up really developing and changing, and I was able to work with those as they grew. And that was nice because, again, sort of plotting it out, maybe this would be different for me next time. But the first time, I didn't necessarily understand, like, how much story fills 16 pages, for instance. I have a very good sense of that for prose, but in terms of, you know, a graphic novel script, I wasn't as sure yet. And so I was like, okay, there's room to do more with this. There's room to explore this a bit more, and it adds to things. So that was something that evolved a lot. But yeah, I knew what the very last moments would be. As far as I understand it, the next book is supposed to come out in January of 2022. I don't know whether or not that could change, but I think January 2022 is the date.
Well, it was great to see these old ideas and storylines. It was great to see the Phantom Zone and all these things.
I know.
Just look at them in new ways. So it was terrifically entertaining.
It was tremendously fun to get to play with those. Like being given the best box of Lego ever.
Well,
really? I get to use all of it? Oh,
I can tell they've got you now.
Yes, absolutely.
We've been talking with Claudia Gray, whose new book, illustrated by Eric Zawadzki, is House of L, Book 1, The Shadow Threat. It's the first in a series about the origin of Superman. Claudia, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? Chris Champagne signs the most interesting league in the world, How the NFL Explains America. Saturday, February 6th from 2 to 4 at a socially distant sidewalk event at Blue Cypress Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.